From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. One of North Carolina's leading school choice groups has a new leader. You'll hear from her. She'll explain why she's pushing for more funding and less regulation of North Carolina's public charter schools. The coronavirus has generated plenty of scary headlines in recent weeks. You'll learn how North Carolina is preparing for possible problems here. A new center slated to open this spring will help military veterans as they transition back to civilian life. You'll learn how. And we'll discuss the impacts for North Carolina of a recent court ruling. It blocks Medicaid work requirements. What could that mean for North Carolina's ongoing debate over Medicaid expansion? Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
News reporting about a recent meeting of business leaders and Governor Roy Cooper notes that the governor said that he didn't hear any of those business leaders ask for a lower corporate tax rate, something that legislative Republicans had included in their 2019 budget. But John Sanders, who is the John Locke Foundation's director of regulatory studies, says that there could be a reason that those corporate executives weren't asking for a tax cut. John joins us now to talk about that. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna.
What caught your eye about the reporting on this story? Because instantly you thought, hey, something's amiss here.
Well, I was reading down the names of the executives there, the corporations that were listed, and I knew that they were all corporations that were getting huge grants from the state of North Carolina from Cooper's administration.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, they were getting corporate incentives grants. So I went through the numbers. Honeywell was listed. They got $42.3 million approved in December of 2018. Avid Exchange got $19.6 million approved also in December of 2018. Allstate got approved $17.8 million in August of 2017. LendingTree got $8.4 million approved in December of 2018. And then Ernst & Young, which is another one there, got $3.2 million approved in 2018 in February.
Help us understand what they were approved for and what it means to the state budget and to taxpayers.
Right. These are job development investment grants, which are 12-year grants to support job creation. So basically, the governor goes and the Commerce Department goes and recruits these companies to either expand or move to North Carolina with the promise of lots and lots of money. And if they meet job creation goals or whatever, then they can, Commerce and the governor can claim credit for the job creation, and these guys can claim a whole lot of money. The sum total at that table in the meeting was $91.5 million.
And so your conclusion was you weren't really shocked that those folks did say, hey, Governor Cooper, we would like a reduction in the corporate tax rate.
Right. Yeah. If you've got nearly $100 million of corporate welfare being handed to you, you know, you're probably not thinking we need a tax cut.
John, tell us about the accountability that one would hope is built into those grants, because you are talking about a sizable amount of money where essentially one business is chosen as somehow to be a winner in terms of finances over their competitors and other businesses in the state. So talk about accountability and this whole rationale of why we would even do this.
Well, the accountability, there is some built in, and there are clawback provisions. So if the promised job creation or investment doesn't take place, then they won't get some of the grant money that they've been promised. WREL has done some reporting in recent years looking at these programs going back for the last 8 years, and they found that a sizable proportion, over a third of them, don't even create a single job. So that money doesn't end up accruing to those companies because of that. But on a larger scale, it is the governor picking winners and losers. It is saying, you know, we value your jobs more than we value jobs from other companies, including companies that are established in North Carolina, small mom and pop shops, those that could actually use corporate tax rate cut. And the corporate tax cut that he's talking about, the one that was in the budget last year, is something called the franchise tax, which is sort of like a double tax on corporations. It's not the corporate income tax. It's a tax on corporate wealth. So whether or not the corporation is doing any good, they're still basically having to pay this tax. It's a very obsolete tax. Only about 14 other states, I think, have one. Maybe 16 other states have it. But very few states have this thing.
So, John, if I were a business executive and I'm out creating jobs, selling products and services, serving the community, trying to grow my business, and I find that there are a select few other businesses who are essentially getting the state to put the state's thumb on the financial scale in favor of my competitor, wouldn't I be squawking about that?
If they've got the time to. I mean, that's the other thing about an entrepreneur, especially a smaller shop owner, is they've got to take to business. They've got to attend to their own business concerns. They don't have time to be pulling on the governor's ear or going to the General Assembly and squawking. They've got things that they've got to do. What bothered me about this is, and it's not as if these corporate executives that were getting the grants went to the governor and said, don't cut taxes. They just didn't mention taxes at all. The governor then turned around and used that sort of dog not barking in the night of them not mentioning tax increases and or tax cuts, and then saying, oh, well, they're not saying it, so we obviously don't need it.
In fact, the implication seemed to be that the Republicans who had proposed trying to help businesses with some sort of tax reform were off the mark, because here were the very people sitting in the room and they didn't even bother to bring it up.
Right.
So, John, do other states do this kind of thing?
Well, and that's one of the other rationales that administrations use for these incentives is, well, if we don't do it, other states will. But economic research finds that they are very rarely the deciding factor in a corporation shifting headquarters or whatever. These things are business decisions. They're made for a host of reasons, very little a bit of which would be access to state incentives.
You know, there might be some folks who think, well, you know, if you want to be pro-business and you want to make sure that North Carolina continues to thrive and that people want to create more jobs, open up businesses, etc., you got to do a little bit of this kind of wheeling and dealing. That may be the governor's view or his commerce department's view. What would you say to them if you had the governor right here talking with him?
I think what I would do is use what the governor said back in Small Business Week, when he went out and touted what a great place North Carolina is for doing businesses. And one of the things that he put in his press release about what makes us great to do business is having the lowest corporate income tax rate among all the states that have corporate income tax rates. So when he's trying to persuade in a different way, he mentions the fact that we've got a low tax environment.
So what is it that actually spurs successful entrepreneurship and businesses to grow?
It's a host of things. It's natural things. It's government that's not getting in the way. It's low regulations, low taxes, a skilled workforce, access to airports and good transportation options.
And you've described North Carolina in a lot of those ways, so many things, which, as you said, the governor has touted before. You know, it's very fascinating because you pointed out, John, that really not a lot of media, if any, picked up on this issue of what happened in that meeting and the governor saying that, well, these business leaders didn't even bring up the issue of taxes. Again, I would say, how would you describe it to someone? What is the essence of what occurred there and the irony of it?
Well, the irony of it is pretending that these corporations that are getting all this money don't need anything else, don't need any more help from the state, and then acting as if they speak for all of the other businesses and corporations in the state.
Well, it's a fascinating piece that you wrote about this, available at johnlock.org. And that discussion about taxes and business leaders and a meeting held with Governor Roy Cooper. John Sanders, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of our state's leading school choice organizations has a new leader, and she joins us now to talk about her new role. Linda Lynn Kakadelis has taken the job as Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition for Charter Schools. Congratulations.
Thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit about your background coming into this, but first of all, the North Carolina Coalition for Charter Schools, what is its role in the whole school choice movement?
Okay. We are a C6 organization, which means that every dime of our money goes to advocacy work. We have two main missions. Number one, work for full funding for charter schools. Many people don't realize that a charter school student receives about 73 cents on the dollar that a district student would receive. So, I mean, that's a pretty big difference. And then also, charter operators have to pay for operating funds the buildings and the classrooms out of that operating budget. So there's a real disparity in funding. So that's our number one mission, is to try to get fair, just funding for charter school students. And then the second point is we're seeing regulatory creep all the time on charter schools, and we want to stop that. Charter schools need to be innovative. So this is an advocacy organization to stop those two things.
And as a reminder, charter schools are public schools, so it is an apples-to-apples comparison about how much money goes to a traditional district school versus how much goes to a charter school. They're all public schools.
Exactly. Each one has to answer to the State Board of Education. They have to take the same exams. The curriculum can be different. There's a little flexibility to the charter schools. But what's the biggest part of accountability is the parent, the family makes the decision to go to a charter school, and they can cross county lines to go to it. Many folks have misconceived ideas about charter schools. I speak to families all the time. Some of them think they're private schools and have to pay tuition. It's like, no. These are options for every family in the state.
Now, you are new to this role as Executive Director of the North Carolina Coalition for Charter Schools, but you are not new to education in North Carolina, either the school choice movement or the traditional public schools. Tell us a little bit about your background and how that's going to help you in this new role.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was a classroom teacher. And then back in the 90s, I decided to run for school board and ran in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, served two terms on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education. While serving there, I had a really unique role of managing $3 million of private scholarship money for scholarships in the area. It was private money at that time. No one knew about there was no opportunity scholarships, but worked with that scholarship organization. Also was on the board of a charter school while still being on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg board. I made a real statement as far as I wanted families to make choices, and I wanted all education providers to be quality.
Now, serving those multiple roles, did you see some of the things that charters could do that traditional district schools would not be able to do?
All the time, Mitch. The charter schools were able to respond quickly to family needs. They didn't have to try to be one
One size fits all.
Yeah, one size fits all. They could meet needs of gifted students. They could meet needs of students that wanted to, you know, spend their curriculum in math and science or even the arts. So they could specialize in those fields. While your district schools, they're trying to be all things to all people at all locations.
And my guess is that the folks that you work with in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, they weren't evil. They weren't out to do bad things. That just the system didn't work well for everyone.
That's exactly right. There are great people in every educational provider. And what we're trying to do is empower families to find the right match for their child.
We are speaking with Linda Lynn Kakadelis. She is the new executive director of the North Carolina Coalition for Charter Schools. You mentioned the two main things that the group is working on. What are some of the ways that you're trying to build interest and knowledge about this funding gap?
Well, we're working with our government relations team on the floor at the General Assembly. Many of the members don't realize the discrepancy. We had back in the late 2000s, there was what they call the Hackney Amendment that came through late one night that took away some of the funding for charter schools. And so we'll be working at looking at ways of repealing that. And then just educating the general public on the values of charter schools, how that charter schools are saving counties millions of dollars with facilities because the counties don't have to pass bonds to build the facilities for charter schools. So we're going to be two-pronged there, working with the General Assembly, but also doing a messaging campaign across the state.
You also mentioned as another goal the fight against the regulatory creep. Why is it so important that charter schools not have more regulations piled on them year after year?
Well, if they do, they're not going to be any different than your district schools. They will have the same regulations, same curriculum, same pacing guides, et cetera, et cetera. And the innovation of charter schools will be limited.
One of the other things that we have seen in recent years is ever since the General Assembly lifted that cap on charter schools, there's been a major growth in charter schools. Has that led to some positives, some negatives, some mixed bag going from slightly less than 100 schools to now almost double that?
What we have learned from that is it takes charter schools a couple of years to get at their pace, to really see that they're exceeding in growth and you know, for people to learn how to run schools. So it takes a little while for them to get where they want to be. The longer the charter school's been open, the better we see the academic performance, which would make sense. It would make sense. Right now, we're at about a little over 116,000 students across the state with almost 200 charter schools. And meanwhile, parents and many stakeholders do not realize the fragile nature, the political fragile nature of charter schools and the freedom we have.
You mentioned that fragile nature. I would suspect that one of the things that you're doing is talking to lawmakers who are supporters and those who are opponents and those who are lukewarm about charter schools and just reminding them what valuable role they play.
Exactly. I don't like to have to say that K-12 education is political, but K-12 education is political.
Shocker.
Elections have consequences. And so we'll be doing a candidate survey, asking candidates their views on charter schools, and then letting the public know what the candidates are saying about that.
In the brief time that we have left, what is your sense of the future for charter schools? Does it look bright? I mean, are we on a good path, or are there some tough obstacles or roadblocks we need to get past?
Well, right now, charter schools, it's been so exciting to see the academic performance of charter schools in subgroups, especially your Black and Hispanic subgroups in elementary, middle, and high school. And what we're seeing is the longer the students are in the schools, the higher their academic performance is. And so we're seeing these gaps in performance start to close. And that's very exciting.
Well, one group that is going to be focusing on the truth about charter schools is the North Carolina Coalition for Charter Schools. Its new executive director, Lindalyn Kakadelis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Coronavirus has been causing concerns around the globe, including North Carolina. State lawmakers recently heard an update on the topic from state epidemiologist Zach Moore. Senator Ralph Hise wanted to know what happens next with this virus that has killed so many people, mainly in China.
I've seen reports here, and a lot of reports about past diagnosis and how many there are out there, and obviously hear all the media reports of how accurate that may not be, given some of its data sources and others and reporting. But have we done any forecasting yet to see where we expect the virus transmission to get and what we would deal with? Do we know what we're preparing for?
There are a lot of uncertainties, so we need to acknowledge that, you know, we could end up with widespread transmission in North Carolina and across the country. We could end up with a situation more like SARS where we're able to contain it and not end up, but I think it's, you know, certainly our plan to be prepared for a situation of widespread transmission so that we're not caught off guard if that does happen. We certainly hope that all the efforts that are being put into containing, which means rapidly identifying potential cases, isolating them, testing them, tracking their contacts, we hope that that will have an impact and at least delay the time when we might have widespread transmission so we can be better prepared. But we do need to be prepared for that possibility. So that's how we're approaching it.
Was that enough to ease Heise's concerns?
It's a general response. I'm just trying to look at if is there forecasts out there that, for timelines we're looking for and what we expect the infection rates to be?
Well, I guess the short answer is yes, there are a lot of different models and people looking at what might happen, but they are all over the map, literally.
State Representative Donnie Lambeth wonders how similar coronavirus is to other illnesses that strike North Carolina and other states and countries every year.
Is this similar to the flu in that it has a seasonal component and at some point you see it reach a peak and then it starts to begin to phase out? And so as we get into the summer, it doesn't exist, or how does this work?
Well, that's another important area of uncertainty. So that is definitely the case with most other coronaviruses that we've seen. The ones that we have every year are very seasonal, causes of the cold. MERS, which is still going on in Saudi Arabia, has a seasonality to it. So we expect that this one might have a seasonality to it also, but it's hard to know. You know, if we're able to keep it out, put it off until warmer weather, how much of a benefit that will be. We would hope it would be beneficial, but hard to know.
That's Zach Moore, state epidemiologist for North Carolina. He's responding to state lawmakers' questions about the future of the well-publicized coronavirus. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Since the 9/11 terrorist attacks 18 years ago, the United States has sent thousands of soldiers to combat zones. Many of the veterans of combat in Iraq and Afghanistan face challenges that make it hard for them to return to civilian life. And that's where our next guest steps in. John Turner is founder and senior advisor for the Veterans Life Center of North Carolina. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mitch. Thanks for inviting me.
First of all, we're going to get into what the Veterans Life Center is, but remind us, when soldiers have served overseas in Iraq or Afghanistan or other places where they've seen combat and have to come back to the United States and try to re-enter civilian life, what are some of the challenges they face?
Well, to be honest, about 14,000 veterans reintegrate back in from active duty service to being a civilian in North Carolina a year. And probably 90% of them do it pretty seamlessly, pretty successfully. So we're really talking about 1,400 veterans a year that have some challenges. And there's a formula for that. If they have some mental health, which could be TBI, which is a physiological injury that you can't physically see.
Traumatic brain injury.
PTSD, which could be physiological, or it could be from traumatic. There are two ways it could be that. Or other injuries. If they're mentally haven't accepted when they're coming home, that leads them to drinking. If they have a family, that could lead to the family breaking apart. And when a veteran does that and then is not able to find or hold and maintain a job, they're really setting up to go into crisis. And crisis consists of suicide, premature death, homelessness, or incarceration.
And these are folks who have been fighting to protect us and to protect our way of life. So it's not something you should just ignore or say, well, it's not a big deal.
No, there was an incident in Moore County, 2010, 2011. A veteran that had deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan from Fort Bragg, came back, got out, had separated from his wife, had become homeless and was drinking. They actually put a warrant out because he was squatting in a house and he hadn't paid his child support. And a sheriff deputy went out to serve that warrant. The sheriff deputy was killed and the veteran committed suicide. That kind of takes all of it. Losing your family, not having a job, not having a place to live, being scared, not understanding that the sheriff deputy was there to help him, led him to not only killing that deputy, but also himself. And think about that tragedy. That's a deputy that went home that didn't have his family. His kids weren't only going to get child support. His kids lost their father for the rest of their life that day. Imagine if there would have been a place in a facility where he could have gone to have gotten the care that he needed to give him some family reintegration or termination to figure out how to prepare him to be a father again, to be a husband again, to have a job and maintain and hold that. There could have been a great thing that day, but instead it was an unbelievable tragedy for two families, the sheriff's family and that veteran's family.
And that leads right into now the Veterans Life Center of North Carolina. Tell us what that is and how this fits into helping these folks.
Well, the Veterans Life Center of North Carolina is a 501c3 nonprofit that is specifically for 21st century veterans. So when we go out and we look for what veterans we're going to bring into the center, they're 21st century veterans. It will have 100 beds. It will have a full kitchen. It will have a case management staff. It will have transportation. We're going to take veterans that are close to being where that veteran from Moore County was. In 2010, 2011, if you called someone, there was no facility like what we are building to go to that. But come May of 2020, there will be a Veterans Life Center. So when someone sees a veteran in that need and they make a call, we will have a bed for them, and we're going to base it off of genuine concern. If you come to the Veterans Life Center, veterans are going to realize that everybody that works there has genuine concern for you. And we're going to do a holistic approach through assessments, assess where they are mentally, assess where they are physically, assess where they are spiritually. And by spiritually, we don't mean religious, but where is their attitude at? And then that's going to affect all their health. And then we're going to create a plan for them. Sit down and talk to them about what do they want to accomplish in life? Where do they want to be in 5 years? You know, a lot of them, when they get to that level of crisis, they're trying to think about where they're going to be in 5 days or 5 hours. But talk to them about where do you want to be in 5 years, and then get them to case management to achieve that. If they need mental health, coordinate their care with the VA. They need some financial planning. Identify what the veteran needs and then deliver that care. One of our great partners is the Vance Granville Community College, their South Campus in Butner, which is 2.3 miles from the facility in Butner. And there they have mechatronics, they have radiography, they have HVAC, they have a variety of vocational training. You're talking about someone who is borderline homeless, if not homeless, and 18 months later, they can have completed either a associate's degree or certification, and they can be having a job that pays about $50,000 a year, which takes them from literally poverty to the middle class. What an amazing thing, and that's what this center can offer.
We are chatting with John Turner, who is founder and senior advisor for the Veterans Life Center of North Carolina. You just mentioned a few moments ago, scheduled to open next spring and in the Butner area. How will the veterans who would most benefit from this, how will they be steered to your center?
We're working with the Cohen Center in Fayetteville, which does mental health care for veterans, working with the VA and numerous other nonprofits like Step Up Ministries for referrals. So our doors are not open. The veteran just doesn't come in at midnight. We are in Butner. It is a rural location, and we were fortunate enough for the state to lease us 9.6 acres. So we're on a secure reservation. So through referral agencies, we will identify, screen, and bring those in. But it's not just the facility is for 21st century veterans. 24 beds will be for female. 76 beds will be for male.
You've mentioned now a couple of times that this is specifically geared toward the 21st century veterans. Why that group and not reaching out to the Vietnam era vets or others who are a little bit older?
Well, for one, I'm a 21st century veteran, and I spent 16 months in Iraq. And I realized people did lay their lives down for each other over there. So why wouldn't we work hard and risk everything back here to do that? So this is really something that's near and dear to my heart. And the guys that I served with, they didn't have to. Every last one of them was a volunteer. And I've been amazed by the outpouring of support from people in North Carolina when they hear about this project that make donations to the Life Center, because they volunteered to serve. And the people in North Carolina, through their donations, have volunteered to build the center for them.
I also imagine that the 21st century veterans have some specific challenges that maybe older veterans do not, because of the type of war, because of the type, the fact that they were all volunteers, and the fact that they're at a younger age. They aren't dealing with other old people health issues.
21st century veterans are definitely different. Every generation of veterans have been different. World War II, the greatest generation, and some of the amazing things that they did. But the population then was about 120 million, and about 20 million people served from 1941 through 1948. So when those men came home and they went and got a job in a factory, there were other veterans, other men of World War II, that they worked with and they talked to. There's about 2.5 million to 3 million, depending on which numbers you read, that have served and been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or other places in the last 18 years. That's less than 1% of the population. There are often times that a veteran will get out and go get a job, and he'll be the only veteran that works there.
That is the voice of John Turner. He is founder and senior advisor for the Veterans Life Center of North Carolina, set to open in the spring in the Butner area. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day: jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A federal appeals court has struck down the state of Arkansas's requirement that able-bodied adults who are receiving Medicaid in that state also have a job or be involved in some related activity. So the question now is, what impact could that decision have on North Carolina and other states? Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's been taking a look at this very question and joins us now. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What did the appeals court rule?
So what the appeals court said was that Arkansas's decision to impose work requirements and the Secretary of Health and Human Services' decision to allow that work requirement was counter to the objective of Medicaid. And statutorily, Medicaid says it's just a means to provide health coverage to people. So by mandating that there be a work requirement or anything else like community engagement, that judge said that that was capricious and arbitrary in his decision, in the secretary's decision to allow this to go forward. So basically, it's not what Medicaid was for, is what the judge said.
Well, if someone is a working age and able-bodied, but for some reason they're on the Medicaid program, is there any common sense reason that that person would not be out working or actively involved in job training, something like that?
Well, you know, there is exemptions in these programs for people with disabilities or people who are taking care of children. So these are the, you know, the, like you said, able-bodied working adults. And the idea is that if we can, you know, encourage people to get a job or go out and seek employment or community engagement in some way, you know, those lead to improved health outcomes. You know, they may find a job that offers health insurance. And so, you know, this is just a sort of nudge to get people, you know, more independent and off of government assistance by finding work.
And in fact, your description is apt because we've heard that argument here in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And to make sure our listeners understand, North Carolina has not expanded Medicaid
right.
under Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
But North Carolina, like the other states, does have a Medicaid program
mm-hmm.
that is shared funding from the feds and the state of North Carolina. So give us a sense of how our Medicaid program works. We don't require people to work, correct?
Correct. That's right.
All right. But we have heard from some of the advocates for expanding Medicaid that, well, the only way that it would be acceptable across the political aisle would be perhaps to have a work requirement.
Mm-hmm.
But Jordan, now that the appeals court has ruled that, what does that mean?
Well, you know, that means that the Republican alternative to Medicaid expansion, the Carolina Cares or Healthcare for Working Families Act, which is essentially just Medicaid expansion with a work requirement, that means that bill is essentially dead. You know, states have been granted work requirements that haven't been challenged in court, but they're not going forward with them because of the precedent set now by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So, you know, if North Carolina wanted to, they could try to go forward. It would almost undoubtedly be challenged in court. And giving the standing or giving the rulings from the appeals court, it doesn't seem like it's likely to hold up. So, you know, Medicaid expansion is still bad policy for North Carolina. Even with a work requirement, we don't think we should do it here. But, you know, for states that do have expanded Medicaid and would like, you know, this work requirement to be in place for their able-bodied population receiving Medicaid, this option is off the table now, which, you know, may, you know, go against their plans in their states, but you know,
yeah, that's going to be fascinating to see what these other states do because
right.
now they're, I'm sure, questioning. Oh my gosh,
right?
We have this work requirement. What does this mean? And mm-hmm. is it fair to say, Jordan, that in at least some of those states that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare, the reasoning and the selling point was, well, we will impose a work requirement. So
right.
there's kind of a give and take, so to speak,
when absolutely
in exchange for adding someone to the government program that they'll be out working.
Right. And, you know, that's what we've seen here in North Carolina. Governor Cooper was willing to go along with the Republicans' Medicaid expansion program because, you know, it achieves his goal of expanding Medicaid and, you know, a little concession to the Republicans. Here's the work requirement. But, you know, we knew all along that the governor didn't really support that plan. He was just going along with it in an attempt to get Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, knowing that the courts eventually would probably strike it down. So as it stands now, Medicaid expansion in North Carolina, with or without a work requirement, doesn't seem like it has a path forward.
You know, there may be some of our listeners, Jordan, who are thinking, my gosh, this Jordan Roberts guy, you know, he has no compassion. He's saying, no, we're not going to add 500,000 to 600,000 people to the Medicaid rolls here in North Carolina. And it's an important discussion, Jordan, because you certainly are not saying that you don't care about people
exactly
and that we don't
right.
have a problem
That's
about
exactly right.
accessing affordable insurance and care. So if not Medicaid, then what?
Well, yeah, you know, that's a great point. You know, conservatives all often get a bad label saying, you know, you don't care about poor people. It's just we have different means to get to the same end. We want everyone to have, you know, as much access to affordable health care as possible, but we know the current system doesn't provide that. But, you know, luckily there are some nonprofit private organizations that are stepping up to, you know, fill the void where the current system is, you know, falling short from people. And one of those is a nonprofit in New York called RIP Medical Debt. And what this company does is it sponsors campaigns all around the country, and, you know, individuals raise money, hand over the money to RIP Medical Debt. And what they do is they purchase portfolios of old medical debt held by those at the bottom end of the income spectrum, for pennies on the dollar and completely forgive the penalty debt free. And, you know, there's already been a ton of successful campaigns. They've wiped out hundreds of millions of dollars of old medical debt. It's a great return on investment, because every dollar they raise on average can wipe out $100 in medical debt. And, you know, this is helping people that, you know, fell victim to a surprise bill, things like that, you know, that just got an unexpected high bill that they can't pay.
Now, I know that you aren't telling the full story here about RIP medical debt. You've described it accurately, of course, but our listeners, I think, would be interested to know that this isn't just theory for you, Jordan. You actually have been involved with this program, and yourself, through your supporters, you've raised more than $30,000 to wipe out the long-term medical debt of low-income North and South Carolinians. Congratulations, number one. That is awesome. But Jordan, talk a little bit, if you would, about the importance of nonprofits and individual people, just helping other people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had a incredible success with my fundraiser. We were able to raise a ton of money that will go to wipe out debt held by those in North and South Carolina, our community members. But, you know, I think, you know, what RIP medical debt represents, you know, while not a panacea, there are plenty of options for the private market to step up and, you know, really accomplish some of the goals of where the current system is falling short. And we know that, you know, through many reasons, there are procedures that aren't paid for by insurance, or people may not have the means to pay for a procedure, and they get slapped with a huge bill that they can't afford. And, you know, lingering medical debt can be crushing for a family. And so what we wanted to do was raise money, you know, as a private entity, and you know, really help these people out that may feel like they have no other options. But, you know, hopefully, you know, in the next couple of months, they'll be getting a letter in the mail that says their medical debt will be wiped out and they can move on with their lives.
Yeah, that is a life-altering event. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. I hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.